So, after our prize giving, it's a pleasure now to turn to the second Thomas Willis lecture. Thomas Willis, as many of you know, was an English physician in the 17th century, working for much of his career in Oxford as a Sedleian Professor of Natural Philosophy, where he played an important role in the history of anatomy, neurology and psychiatry. We're delighted that this year the Medical Sciences Division, I'm delighted to see the Dean, Alistair Buchan here, has named the lecture also the Lichfield Lecture, named after the 3rd Earl of Lichfield, who in the reign of George III bequeathed a sum of money to the university on condition that the income was used to provide clinical instruction in Oxford for members of the university. So it's therefore a great honour to introduce our speaker this afternoon, Dennis Selko, the Vincent and Stella Coates Professor of Neurologic Diseases at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. He and his team have done so much over the years to advance our knowledge of the molecular and cellular basis of neurological diseases, in particular Alzheimer's disease. Professor Selko is a graduate of Columbia University and the University of Virginia School of Medicine, and after initial training at the National Institutes of Health, he completed a residency in neurology at the Harvard Longwood Program and a postdoctoral fellowship on neuronal cell biology and neurochemistry in the Department of Neuroscience. At Harvard, right. In 1978, he founded a laboratory applying biochemical and cell biological techniques to the study of human degeneration. Selko and his co-workers broke new ground in 1982 when he developed a method to isolate the abnormal neurofibrillary tangles that are the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease and described their unusual chemical properties. With other labs, they identified the microtubule-associated protein tau as a principal component of these tangles. He then turned his attention to the other hallmark lesion of Alzheimer's, of amyloid plaque, and has conducted extensive experiments on the amyloid beta protein and its precursor APP. The results led him to formulate a theory, the amyloid hypothesis, about the pathogenic cascade that causes Alzheimer's disease. In 1992, Professor Selko and his collaborators discovered the A-beta is continuously produced by normal cells throughout life, and the unexpected finding initiated the dynamic study of amyloid beta formation in cultured cells, and that's enabled him to look at a number of different inhibitors of this production line. He's also shown that the number of inherited mutations in APP and later the presenilin genes caused Alzheimer's disease by increasing the generation of amyloid beta. He's received numerous awards, as you can imagine, including the Potemkin Prize, the Metropolitan Life Foundation Award, and the A.H. Heineken Prize for Medicine. Professor Selko is a member of the Institute of Medicine and the National Academies and a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And in 2001, with Joe Martin, he founded the Harvard Center for Neurodegeneration and Repair. So it's a real privilege for us in the NAFRA Department of Clinical Neurosciences for Professor Selko to find time from his very busy schedule to come over to visit us in Oxford. We've had a pretty busy schedule for him. He's met lots of people in the department over the last couple of days. And I want to thank him very much for agreeing to come to give the Thomas Willis and Lichfield Lecture, which is entitled Protein Misfolding and the Molecular Bases of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's Disease. Professor Selko.
Afternoon. I hope none of you have altitude sickness. This is a much steeper auditorium than we have at Harvard Medical School, so I might get a little bit of wry neck looking up. I'm delighted to be with you, and I'm really deeply honored to give perhaps two named lectureships, one for Thomas Willis, about whom all of us know a great deal, and one for Lord Lichfield, who I actually know much less about, perhaps you also. But I did get some information, thanks to Chris's office and my colleague George DeForest, who's been my principal host here, and I thank him for his hospitality, that among many titles that Lord Litchfield had, one was the Lord of the Bedchamber of George III. Now, I'm a Yank, and I don't really know how to conceptualize what it means to be the Lord of the Bedchamber of the King of England. And so I thought about this a little bit, and I thought to myself, well, what if we had something similar? Now, we used to be Brits, we broke away, we have a president, we don't have a king. And I thought to myself, well, what if I had the distinction of being the Lord of the Bedchamber to one of the presidents? For example, can you imagine being the Lord of the Bedchamber to John Kennedy? I think that would be a very interesting experience. Or the Lord of the Bedchamber to Bill Clinton. I think that it probably was even more interesting to do that than to be the Lord of the Bedchamber to King George III, who had porphyria, and perhaps in his delusional state from porphyria, he let the colonies go, or couldn't do something about it. So I find it terribly interesting that there are titles of this sort, Lord of the Bedchamber. I don't know if there's also a Lord of the Bathroom or what else there is, but in any event, perhaps I'm being a little inhospitable to my my hosts here in the UK. And in fact, I'm very honored to be associated with both Litchfield and, of course, Thomas Willis. So today I have the privilege of sharing with you some of my thoughts and ideas about two major neurodegenerative diseases. And because this is a sophisticated audience, I'm going to move along fairly quickly and ask you to follow along. And there will be a couple of conclusion slides that punctuate my talk, and you can catch up with what I've been thinking and doing. So the application of cell biology and biochemistry and electrophysiology and ultrastructure and genetic modeling to human neurodegenerative diseases has been my career-long work. And I focused mostly on the two diseases I'll speak about. I think the common theme that I'll share with you and share with all the students, some of whose posters I saw today, is about being cautious in designing your experiments to not perturb Mother Nature too much, to not load up cells and mouse brains with too much excess exogenous protein, but to stick to first principles and study nature as it is coming to us so it reveals its secrets properly. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that. All of us abuse cells and tissues and mice, but we wish to do it as little as possible if we want to really see what happens in nature, and in this example, in human disease. So I'll just mention that I am a consultant and director of a little company called Prothena Biosciences, but that has nothing to do with anything that I'll tell you about today, although I'll be happy to answer questions about what they do at some later moment. So I'm going to give you a little bit of introductory material. A lot of you don't work directly on the topics that I care about, but then I'm going to move into new data, and I'm going to present at least two stories that are unpublished. So you'll have to commit it to memory or take notes, because you won't be able to look back at our papers. It's punctuated, however, with some things that are published to put it in perspective. And this is one of them. When Christian Haass and Michael Schlossmacher were working in my lab, we discovered together that the generation of the amyloid beta protein that, in my view, has an importance in the etiology of Alzheimer's occurs normally throughout life in all primates, and actually in cats and dogs at home as well. And what we were able to show is that if the amyloid precursor protein is at the surface of a cell, a canonical cell here, or in a luminative vesicle, there is a cleavage by beta secretase that you just saw that releases a large part of the ectodomain of APP. It's followed by a very unusual cleavage in the membrane, which is bizarre, because hydrolysis of peptide bonds obviously requires water, and you would expect that this would happen in an aqueous environment. But the cleavage happens in the membrane, and this was perhaps the first example of intramembranous proteolysis when we discovered this, a phenomenon in biochemistry that later was nicknamed RIP, regulated intramembrane proteolysis, by none other than Brown and Goldstein, based in part on our work and in part on their own work on site 2 protease in SREBP processing. So this second cleavage occurs within the membrane and releases a part of amyloid precursor protein A beta that was first defined by George Wenner in 1984 and that comes out as a monomer that you and I make throughout life. And early in life, you principally have monomers in your spinal fluid, in your plasma, in the extracellular fluid of your muscles. This happens in all tissues, and we'll get in a moment to why Alzheimer's is a brain disease, because all the gene products are ubiquitous in mammals. So the A-beta dimers perhaps form at some point during life, and A-beta trimers can form, and tetramers, and larger oligomers. So collectively, we call these oligomers, a few mers. And those oligomers can eventually polymerize into protofibrils and fibrils, which was the starting point for Glenner's seminal discovery of this protein, A beta, in 1984. And the fibrils form amyloid plaques. This is an image of two spherical deposits of amyloid beta protein plaques from a patient I followed during life. So this gentleman was 60 when he came to see me in clinic. At 69, he was dead. His mother had died in her early 70s of an early onset form of Alzheimer's. And in the amygdala of my patient's brain, we saw typical amyloid plaques and nerve fibrillary tangles. So the plaques are extracellular masses of the amyloid beta protein that I've talked to you about. The tangles are something quite different. They're made up of the tau protein, which my lab and three other labs discovered in 1986. So before any genetics of Alzheimer's disease became clear, a few of us, George Glenner and Colin Masters and myself and John Hardy, surmised that Alzheimer's disease would turn out to be an imbalance between the production and the clearance of the amyloid beta protein, especially the 42 amino acid fragment that comes from APP that leads to its accumulation in brain regions serving memory and cognition. And we imagine the imbalance could be caused by distinct genetic alterations before the first gene was discovered. Really, the first gene was found in hereditary cerebral hemorrhage with amyloidosis, the Dutch type, by Blas Fangioni and his colleagues in the Netherlands. But then, shortly after that, Alison Goh and John Hardy in London discovered the famous London mutation in a bona fide Alzheimer kindred. So there may be environmental factors that also lead to this, and we can speculate about those if there's time for questions at the end. Now, Arthur Schopenhauer, a sometime antagonist of Nietzsche and competitor of his and compatriot, would tell you that all truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as being self-evident. So the concept here is that the hypothesis that I've spent a lot of my time on has been ridiculed, it has been violently opposed, and recently there begins to be a sense that if this all makes sense, and it's not really a thunderclap, we expect that a hydrophobic protein self-aggregates and forms deposits in the tissue, and it's probably just as well if I didn't have those in my brain. But the hypothesis is still controversial, and there's lots to be said about it, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. The best way to diminish the controversy around this notion that A-beta dishomeostasis causes the disease is to look for genetic validation, because genetics is unbiased. And when that was done by geneticists, not certainly by myself, but what my lab does is genotype to phenotype relationships, four chromosomes and four cognate genes on those chromosomes were ultimately implicated in Alzheimer's, and everyone agrees about those. And as you know, if you follow this field, there are many other genes implicated, all of which have very small effect sizes in late onset Alzheimer's, and there's no one dominant gene. So these four genes began with essentially Hardy's discovery of an APP mutation and a kindred from this country. And we modeled that very shortly and showed that the arrow pointed up in terms of the phenotype of amyloid beta in the brain biochemically. Then along came work by Warren Strittmatter and Alan Roses at Duke University that this naturally occurring APOE4 allele would predispose to Alzheimer's, and we also studied that and found that A-beta production was not altered, but the steady state level of A-beta plaques and blood vessel deposits was elevated. So as if the steady state level was up, but it wasn't a matter of production. And later on, David Holtzman at Washington University did some of the best work to show that what seems to be the problem is the clearance of A-beta. It's not a production problem as it is with APP mutations, but a clearance problem. Finally, presenilin 1 and presenilin 2, defined by Peter St. George Hislop, first and foremost in PS1, and then by his lab and Rudy Tanzi and collaborators for PS2, we modeled those with Peter and showed that they increase the production of A-beta 42 peptides in particular. So this all gave genetic validation to the concept that dishomeostasis, abnormal economy of A-beta, was a starting point. But whether all of these clinical familial forms of the disease really mimic idiopathic disease is unclear. So let me tell you about one of the molecules we most like to study in the lab, presenilin 1 and presenilin 2, which is a homolog and has very similar functional and pathological properties. In 1999, Mike Wolff, Weiming Sha, and myself made the observation that presenilin, which was known to be a gene causing familial Alzheimer's, as I just told you, but had unknown function, turned out to be the first in biology intramembrane aspartyl protease. So here is the diagram in the single amino acid code of every residue of 467 amino acids in presenilin, and there are two and only two aspartates that we noticed and spotted and looked back in evolution and found that these were conserved going back to Drosophila and to C. elegans and even Archibacter. And those two aspartates, we reasoned, were the active site of a aspartyl protease. Why did we say such a thing? Because we already had evidence from small molecule inhibition that you could lower A-beta production in a healthy cell by using aspartyl protease inhibitors like pepstatin that you can buy commercially. So we knew that there was something about aspartyl proteases, and we just noticed that two, but only two, aspartates occurred in two of the nine transmembrane domains of presenilin. We mutated one of these at a time. You didn't have to mutate both, because an aspartyl protease, like HIV protease, for example, won't work if one of these aspartates are missing. You need to have one protonated, one not. They need to cleave a peptide bond. And long story short, this was very unpopular and controversial. When we first presented this in neuroscience, there were lots of boos in the audience, B-O-O-S. B-O-O-Z-E is what we drank that night to try to bolster our egos. But in a year or so, Christian Haas and other groups had confirmed this. So a summary diagram of what I've just told you is that APP is a holoprotein in the membrane of a neuron or any number of other cells. Can have the two aspartates in presenilin, shown here in a simple cartoon in purple, coordinate with the end of the amyloid beta region, shown as a red box. Before that, there would be a beta secretase cleavage, and that would be released. And another of the 100 substrates that also undergoes this kind of intramembrane proteolysis is Notch, as you may know, and this is crucial for life in metazoans. So in a way, Alzheimerology led to the identification of presenilin, for sure, and the recognition that it was an intramembrane aspartyl protease, the first one in biology, and that it had a crucial function in life. Now, I like to look at this cartoon and say this is how it is that Alzheimer's disease arose in the human population, and probably in the monkey population as well. The reaction on the left is conserved throughout evolution and is very important. The reaction on the right is much less biologically crucial, You cannot knock notch out of the metazone. It will not mature. It will die. You cannot knock APP out of a metazone or out of a mammal, and the animal will live. There are homologs. But still, this reaction came along for the ride when this reaction was conserved during evolution. So presenilin is the gamma secretase, we believe. It has three partners, and I'll tell you about that now. But it is the main intramembrane protease that generates A beta, the final step that makes you have A beta. And if it weren't conserved in evolution to process notch, I think presenilin would not be here to cause Alzheimer's. Now, why does Alzheimer's occur in the brain and not in the kidney, the muscle, or the skin? Probably because beta secretase, the first cleaving enzyme, is particularly highly expressed in neurons, and much more so than in other cells. Whereas presenilin, in purple here, is ubiquitously expressed because it's necessary for life and cell fate determination in essentially all cells. I'm going to tell you a new unpublished story about a multi-secretase complex that changes the model for how sequential processing of substrates, APP being one of them, occurs in the process that Brown and Goldstein call RIP. And this is the work of Alan Chen, who's a very talented senior postdoctoral fellow who got his PhD at Harvard Medical School, and the work is under review at Cell, and we're duking it out with the reviewers. Something that you probably don't have to do around here, but we have a hard time. And Alan is home now doing further experiments, but I'm going to tell you what he's done already, because we feel excited about this new model. So currently, it's believed that the processing of single transmembrane proteins comes something like this. If the amyloid precursor protein is sitting in the membrane, there is a event that releases the ectodomain, the shedding event of the ectodomain, and now the C-terminal stub of APP or notch or ERBB4 or neuregulin or the beta 2 subunit of the voltage-gated sodium channel, all of these then find their way into the gamma secretase complex where the two spartates can clip, where presenilin, shown here in blue or light blue, can do its work. But Alan discovered that if you went to endogenous tissues, don't overexpress, et cetera, which I warned you about earlier, such as healthy wild-type mouse brains, and you pull down by immunoprecipitation from microsomes solubilized in 1% NP40, which is known to break up the so-called gamma secretase complex. Presenilin, which is a heterodimer normally and is the active site, as I said, and then three other proteins that are part of gamma secretase, APH1, PEN2, and nicastrin. He found that pulling down APH1 brought down full-length APP, but not so when you pull down nicastrin or the presenilin N-terminal fragment, other components of gamma secretase. So under dissociating conditions, it was APH1 that bound the full-length APP. And we ask ourselves, why would you need full-length APP to interact with gamma secretase complex? Because it isn't the real substrate, it's the C-terminal stub, as my earlier cartoon showed you. So now a new model, a new cartoon, APP is a full-length molecule. APH1 is a binding site for full-length APP, according to Alan's data. Here in blue is presenilin with its two red aspartates showing. PEN2 is tucked back here. Nicastrin is the one with the large ectodomain. And because both APP and all other substrates have an ectodomain that might have steric hindrance from nicastrin, we imagine that you got a signal or ligand to the APP ectodomain. In the case of notch, that would be delta or jagged that would trigger the cleavage. Then there would be a cleavage event near the membrane, 12 amino acids away, and the ectodomain would be dispensed with. And now the C-terminal fragment could be within the transmembrane domain coordinating with presenilin. And even the movement that this cartoon suggests may not even be much of a distant movement, that they're all together, signifying that alpha secretase, the first shedding protease, is present there too. And I'll show you the data for this new model. First of all, Alan was able to show an interaction between ADAM10, which is the principal alpha secretase that sheds the ectodomain of APP and many other substrates, in neurons. So ADAM10 is the principal neuronal alpha secretase and gamma secretase. And you could show that You could pull down another atom member, tumor necrosis factor enzyme that is TACE or atom 17 or atom 10. This is a TNF-alpha converting enzyme. And he brought down presenilin NTF and CTF with mature atom 10 when that was the pull down in normal neuronal cells, neuroblastoma cells that are not overexpressing. More importantly, in wild-type mouse brain, two different atom 10 antibodies precipitated the presenilin C-terminal fragment under non-dissociating conditions in CHAPSO. And here are two more examples. In the lower left are three different atom antibodies, atom 10, 17, and 9, and only atom 10 in mouse brain, the neural alpha-synuclein can pull down the presenilin CTF. The other two do not do that. And here on the right is the other way around. The presenilin CTF immunoprecipitation brings down all the members of the gamma complex, the NTF that's its partner, and APH1 and PEN2, which is not shown here, and principally mature, but some immature atom 10. Now, this was also done at the cell surface, which is where these proteases act in your neurons and mine. So what we did was to biotinylate cells, yes or no, and then pull down for APH1, the gamma component that we think interacts with full-length substrates first, and then take that material, resuspend it, and pull down with streptavidin. So we did a PEN2 IP. APH1 is the first component that interacts with the substrate. PEN2 is the last component of gamma, so it's mature gamma secretase. You pull down with that, you resuspend, and you pull down with streptavidin. And there in the right-hand lane, you see mature atom 10 coming down, but not immature, together with all of the members of the gamma secretase complex in the presence of biotin, but not in the absence of biotin. So therefore, these are all at the cell surface, a place where we know the substrate is processed. Now, he went on to show that besides exclusion chromatography on the super 06 column, he could separate a high molecular weight complex, probably larger than 2 megadaltons, 2,000 kilodaltons, and that high molecular weight complex on a gradient will fractionate so the mature forms of gamma secretase, the NTF and CTF of presenilin and mature nicastrin, will co-fractionate with mature atom 10, with very little immature atom 10. So the mature proteases are together. And if you then look at the low molecular weight region, there is immature full-length polar protein of presenilin, which is not proteolytically active, and some immature atom 10. Now you can IP from each of these size exclusion chromatography pools, and I'm highlighting in red what happens if you IP from pool 6, for example, and you can bring down nicastrin, top arrow, then presenilin CTF, and then mature atom 10 by two different antibodies. And it's the mature atom 10, the immature is brought down from a low molecular weight complex. So it's a high molecular weight complex that has both proteases. What about function? So he asked whether the polar activity of the alpha-gamma secretase complex can be reconstituted by pulling down one or the other protease. And the way you do that in our field is you take a canonical substrate of gamma secretase, which is the last 100 amino acids of APP, or you can do this with Notch just as well, or with many other substrates, and you expect that if you offer that substrate a source of gamma secretase in vitro, in a test tube experiment, you will cleave in the membrane by the action of presenilin and release a beta into the lumen of a vesicle or the extracellular space and the AICD cytoplasmic domain into the cytoplasm. So what Alan did first and foremost was to do a control reaction showing that if you pull down with beads alone or with an irrelevant antibody, you didn't get anything, of course. You didn't get any gamma secretase activity of this sort. But if you pull down for presenilin from mouse brain microsomes or from overexpressing cells, you got robust gamma secretase cleavage. This here is a beta, shown in red, and this here is a beta here, and this is AICD, shown down here. And you could inhibit that with a gamma secretase inhibitor, a spiral protease inhibitor. That's fine. If you pull down gamma secretase, you should get gamma secretase activity. But more interesting was this panel, where he pulled down for alpha secretase, atom 10, from a cell, or from a brain microsome prep, and now could again show that you produced product. A-beta and AICD were again produced so that the alpha secretase pull-down had gamma secretase activity. And you could block that with a gamma secretase inhibitor right here. You don't see the products. This little band is made from the substrate, C100, and is C83. If you're in this field, you know that this is the ADAM10 product from C99. It makes C83. And if you block it with TAPI, a metalloprotease inhibitor, you no longer get it. This data is quantified here. And so a ADAM10 IP will pull down gamma secretase activity. If you use ADAM10 with a gamma secretase inhibitor, there's no activity, of course. And if you use ADAM10 pull down with inhibitor of ADAM10 itself, that doesn't change the ability to cleave. And the next set of data is the opposite, is to say, if you pull down for gamma secretase, do you have alpha secretase activity? And the answer is yes. First of all, PEN2 IPs bring down mature ADAM10, whereas APH1, an earlier member of the complex, brings down mostly immature ADAM10. And then you can see here in the two bars on the right that pulling down PEN2 or pulling down APH1 gamma components, and then measuring alpha secretase activity leads to proteolysis. And then finally, this story includes a very interesting feedback mechanism. So if Lilly or another company wants to inhibit gamma secretase chronically, they need to watch out for this phenomenon. When Allen applied a series of known gamma secretase activities, such as Bristol-Myers Squibb compound avagacistat that had been in clinical trials, or Lilly's compound, he could inhibit gamma secretase, which is shown by a buildup in the cell of the C-terminal fragments of APP that can't be processed. And you can see variable levels of this. This one doesn't inhibit very strongly. This doesn't inhibit at all. And APPS alpha goes up as a result of gamma secretase activity going down, as if there's a call by the cell for more ectodomain shedding. This is quantified here, so that every time there is strong gamma secretase inhibition, there is more APPS alpha released into the medium of the treated cell. In this bar and this bar, there's weak gamma secretase inhibition and not as much APPS alpha shedding. And this correlates with an 0.86 R-squared value. Beta secretase processing is the converse. It has to go down because the APP molecule is cleaved by alpha secretase first. Now, there is not the case if you have gamma secretase modulators. If you follow our field, gamma secretase inhibitors have been a problem because they inhibit Notch processing, but gamma secretase modulators don't interfere with the actual cleavage event. Rather, they push it from one residue to another. They tweak gamma secretase so that you still have actual cleavage, but at a different site. And then finally, Allen found also that beta secretase interacts with gamma secretase. And that's shown here in two co-IP experiments. Base 1 or beta secretase comes down when you pull down presenilin and vice versa. But ADAM10, base does not come down when you pull down ADAM10 and vice versa. ADAM10 doesn't come down when you pull down base. So the message is that base interacts with gamma secretase, but not in the same complex with ADAM10. So let me pause and tell you what I've just said, that we believe that for fundamental biology, there is a special feedback mechanism in the regulated intermembrane proteolysis of 100 different substrates and counting. This model suggests an efficient way to have sequential processing of full-length gamma substrates. Gamma secretase interacts with ADAM10 at overexpressed and endogenous levels, and as I mentioned, on the plasma membrane. The alpha and gamma enzymes co-fractionate in the high molecular weight complex, and that can be co-IP'd from that fraction. The alpha-gamma complex that we find in cells is proteolytically active. So ADAM10 IPs contain gamma secretase activity, vice versa, gamma secretase IPs contain alpha secretase activity. I didn't tell you that the entire maturation of the ADAM10 protease depends in part on gamma secretase. The higher you express gamma secretase, the more mature ADAM10 becomes. So they're coordinately regulated. And then gamma secretase activity regulates alpha and or beta secretase processing. By that I mean that if you inhibit gamma secretase, you interestingly enough increase alpha secretase cleavage. And we know a little bit about the mechanism that I won't get into but be happy to answer about. Beta secretase, which is important in Alzheimer's disease, has a similar relationship with gamma secretase, but apparently in a different complex. So everything I've told you so far is about this aspect of the life cycle of amyloid beta protein, its production. And now I'm going to get into how I think Alzheimer's disease really arises in your parents or my parents or your grandparents or me. And that is, if you produce A beta too much during life, you have to handle it properly by degradation. I won't tell you about that, but we've worked on that. Or it will aggregate, as many self-associating proteins do. And the aggregation process is something that Kanish Shankar in my lab, an MD PhD student at Harvard, studied to advantage. He did something that you do here too. He collected brain tissue. If Kathy Yoakum had still been in my lab now, she would be my collaborator on this work. Sadly, she took James' offer and came over to Oxford, and it all worked out fine. The fact is that in our lab, we have our own brain tissue collection, and we took 80 sample 4, 5, 6, and 7. We had age-matched controls. All humans make A-beta. You don't see hardly any A-beta in the alternate lanes. That's because at this level of exposure, the monomer of A-beta is very low in amount and doesn't show up. But here in the Alzheimer brains, and in all the ones we look at, there's abundant SDS-stable dimers in addition to monomers at 4 and 8 kilodalton, where A-beta should run. And so Ganesh took this material, and he did, with Xiaomin Li in my lab, an electrophysiological experiment. We do quite a lot of E-phys because it's a very sensitive way to see the badness of a misfolded protein. And in red, sample 4 here, floated onto a healthy wild-type mouse hippocampal slice, will inhibit long-term potentiation in the canonical CA3 Schaefer collateral CA1 pathway. In blue is control 1, and that won't do it. And then if you immunodeplete the A-beta out of this sample, shown here, and the second western blot lane is after immunodepletion, actually 3 rounds of it, now the Alzheimer brain extract no longer interferes with this renowned correlate of memory, long-term potentiation. Now, the same thing happens if you want to induce synaptic depression, long-term depression. Xiaomin Li showed that in the presence of a controlled tris-buffered saline extract, you can use a low-frequency stimulus of 1 hertz over 5 minutes, so 300 stimuli. That doesn't induce long-term synaptic depression compared to baseline. But if you do it in the presence of this brain extract from Alzheimer's brain, you induce long-term synaptic depression. And we studied this with Bernardo Sabatini, who is an expert in synaptic biology and physiology, and confirmed these results. So that's long-term potentiation that many of you in neurobiology are familiar with. What about the cardinal symptom of Alzheimer's? If I get Alzheimer's, I'm going to forget what I'm telling you, and you're going to certainly, if you get it, forget what I just said. In a rat, we can try to approximate that by taking a rat, putting a cannula in its lateral ventricle, which you don't see here, so we don't show an image that upsets certain animal rights folks. But in point of fact, after a cannula is surgically implanted, the work of Ganesh Shankar with Kieran Regan and Dominic Walsh at that time in Dublin, you can instill in the lateral ventricle soluble oligomers from the brains of patients that I followed during life. So if you will, this is sort of Koch's postulates. You try to translate the material from the human brain into the healthy adult rat. These are not transgenic rats, etc. They're healthy rats. And we know that whether the cannula is present or not, if you let the rat go into its favorite open dark chamber and give it a single foot shock, it scampers back to a well-lit, less comfortable chamber, and the next time you put it in that box, it will stay in the chamber on your right because it'll remember that. But when we infused in oligomers from my patients' brains, then the rat didn't remember. And as soon as you put it in, within about 20 seconds, it began wandering into the open, dark chamber. We didn't need to shock it again because we'd made our point. This rat had forgotten that, but if you first immunodepleted the material from my patient's brain extract, the rat did remember. Or if you put in control brain from a 78-year-old woman who didn't have Alzheimer's, then the rat got it and didn't go back in. And this was very tightly timed. If you did the retest at about 24 hours after the injection, you'd start to see the effect. You saw it much more if you retested the animal 48 hours after the injection. So by the time it had laid down this memory, probably requiring some level of protein synthesis. Now, Ganesh, when he did these experiments, also answered a very important question in Alzheimerology, the plaques. So he did a method that Kathy will vaguely remember that I actually developed in 1985, 86, when I was at McLean Hospital, not as a patient actually at McLean, which some think I should be, but actually as an investigator. And we developed a method to use fluorescence-activated cell sorting to get rather clean amyloid plaque for preps. And Ganesh unearthed that method from our files, and he used the same thing. These are a typical Congo red stained image that everyone here in neuropathology will be familiar with. When these plaques are washed and they're isolated cores sequentially, you can eventually get to a point where soluble monomers and dimers, and by the way, lots of higher oligomers too. By denaturing gels, you only see the dimer at 8 kilodalton, but there are higher oligomers, and they wash away. You switch from SDS to tris-buffered saline, make these cores nice and clean, as they look at here in the microscope, and then Ganesh, with Xiaomin Li, floated them onto a wild-type slice of mouse hippocampus. And in red, you see the result. That's from fraction 3 here. And in blue, you see a control core prep, which is just our nickname. There aren't any cores in a control 78-year-old woman's brain, but there are in the 78-year-old woman who had Alzheimer's disease. So there was no effect of these amyloid plaque cores on synaptic plasticity. But if Ganesh first dissolved these in a harsh reagent formic acid, which Colin Masters first used to advantage to solubilize amyloid plaque cores, you can do this with guanidine hydrochloride, then neutralized, and then put plaque equivalent amounts onto a slice, you see here that in red, now this fraction did impair LTP. So the concept is that the plaques are at least temporarily protective, and it's like jails in London. Is it good to have jails or bad? Perhaps it's good because the chances that I'm going to get stabbed in the back on the way to my car late in the night are less. But there is an off rate from those plaques or jails, and eventually you can get bioactive soluble oligomers that cause trouble. Now, we've done a lot of electrophysiology and other synaptic biological processes, and I'll just summarize in this summary diagram that we published in 2009 that the process of inducing long-term synaptic depression in an excitatory synapse has been well studied, and there are a great many signaling cascades, three of which we've highlighted here. And if you add amyloid beta oligomers from my patient's brain or your patient's brain, you now show these as dimers and trimers and tetramers and dodecamers floating in the extracellular fluid. We do these kinds of experiments. And what we think is a principal mechanism is that you interfere with glutamate reuptake. So glutamate transporters, especially in neurons, we've done this with astrocyte inhibition. We've done it now genetically, which I'm not going to show you, knocking out astrocyte glutamate transports or neuronal glutamate transports. It seems that neuronal glutamate reuptake is screwed up by having soluble beta oligomers at picomolar concentrations on a healthy hippocampal slice. And so you want to diminish that. You can see the increased extracellular glutamate that causes perhaps extrasynaptic stimulation, sort of a glutamate spillover and NR2B stimulation. So the last thing to tell you about Alzheimer's disease is connecting the A-beta plaques and the tau, the neurofibrillary tangles. Because you know that histopathologically, Alzheimer in 1906 described the concatenation of these lesions as the syndrome. So what has been done by Ming Jin in my lab is to take the natural A-beta monomers and dimers that are made in human brain and take AD extracts and separate them by size exclusion chromatography. Control brain at the same age has very little or no A-beta oligomers present. But you can separate dimers from monomers. And then you can put them on healthy cultured neurons. This is no treatment here. The neurons look beautiful at fully 20 days in vitro. These are healthy rat hippocampal neurons. But here on the right, fraction 8 or 9 in our SEC analysis is a dimer-rich fraction. 10 and 11 is a monomer-rich fraction, which is a lovely control. The dimers impair synaptic and neuritic integrity and cause profound bleeding. You can also show that one of the other hallmarks of the neurofibrillary state, tau hyperphosphorylation, two epitopes that the Madelkoffs and others have shown us are elevated in phosphostate in Alzheimer's brain. The neurons have more phosphorylation at these epitopes when you put on A-beta dimers, in fact, number 4 here, and if you now immunodeplete, you can return the tau level to normal. Furthermore, if you knock tau out of a neuron, now the soluble A-beta oligomers from my patients' brains don't really cause much in the way of harm. I don't think that they're innocuous, but they cause much less harm. So tau is absent now by siRNA, two different tau, and now the neuritic architecture with tubulin staining is much more intact than when tau is expressed. And then finally, you can use antibodies like Dale Schenk first imagined. 3D6, which failed in clinical trials, is bapineuzumab, a commercial N-terminal antibody, but not a C-terminal antibody. So here's no rescue with antibody. You have lots of neuritic dystrophy compared to the normal state. These two antibodies rescue. This one doesn't. So to finish up on Alzheimer's, mechanistically connecting A-beta oligomers from Alzheimer's patients' brains to tau alteration impaired memory is a type of trying to fulfill Koch's postulates. The soluble A-beta oligomers isolated from the brains of typical patients impair memory upon injection to healthy adult rats. Soluble oligomers can inhibit LTP, facilitate synapse depression, and induce synapse loss in rodent hippocampus. Insoluble amyloid cores are largely inactive, but contain abundant soluble A-beta oligomers that are toxic to synapses if they're first released from cores. So the cores may be temporarily protected. Soluble oligomers induce abnormal tau phosphorylation rather directly, connecting the two lesions, although we do not know the mechanism by which they do that. And there's a profound neurite injury, but not if the tau protein is deleted. Then the tubulin cytoskeleton is all right. Certain antibodies to A-beta can bind and neutralize the effects of the human A-beta oligomers on tau and the cytoskeleton. So how we think this happens in your brain and mind if we're developing Alzheimer's is that there is a continuum of A-beta forms, monomers, dimers, trimers, protofibrils, plaques, diffuse plaques, and the solubility of these, this is not time here, but a curve of solubility, is much greater here. And the bioactivity seems to correlate best with small soluble oligomers. And we hypothesize that the capacity for amyloid cores to sequester additional soluble A-beta oligomers that you're making throughout life becomes saturated as A-beta levels rise with age. So the garage is full and you can't park any more cars in it. And now you have a little bit of a worry. I'll finally tell you about Alzheimer's that amyloid is almost certainly both a cause and an effect. This has been a big debate in the field. There are high pathology controls that have lots of amyloid in their brains, but they're not demented. How do we explain that? In systemic amyloidosis, we know they can occur as primary events or secondary disorders. Transthyretin can be mutant, then it's causative. If it's a wild-type transthyretin, something else triggers its accumulation. Similarly, A-beta accumulation is a primary cause in patients with APP or presenilin mutations. In late-onset Alzheimer's, it occurs secondary to other causes, like APOE4 and perhaps increased base activity. Most importantly, time on the planet, which is more than just the concept of aging. You don't have to be old if you have a presenilin mutation that heightens your likelihood of getting Alzheimer's. You can be 18, which is the youngest case on record that I'm aware of. And so time is important to overcome the energy barrier for self-association of A-beta. Now, what to do about it in the clinic? Dale Schenk and his colleagues had nothing to do with this work, suggested vaccinating with A-beta would clear amyloid deposits in a mouse model of Alzheimer's. And that had its pluses and minuses. It eventually came over to, instead of actively vaccinating, making an antibody in a company and infusing it once a month or once every 3 months. And that led Eli Lilly to report these data. that in two clinical trials, Expedition 1 and 2, 18 months of treatment, or 80 weeks, began to lead to a splaying of the lines for this particular cognitive test, the ADAS-Cog14. Lower is better in this scoring system, and so the red antibody-treated subjects after 80 weeks had about a 34% less decline in cognitive scores. And that's shown here, and that was highly statistically significant. It began around 24 weeks. This is an antibody that I would want myself or my wife to be on, and indeed it's going back into, it is already in both clinical trials in mild Alzheimer's and in prevention mode, in secondary prevention. So what I now want to tell you about is alpha-synuclein, the A-beta of Parkinson's disease, I'd like to say, provocatively. That is, if A-beta has the salience that I just described to it, perhaps synuclein is doing something similar. It's sometimes mutant. Mostly A-beta is not mutant. It's just wild type, but it accumulates in the disease. And you know about Parkinson's, and you studied it to great advantage here at Oxford and the Radcliffe Infirmary. Since 1996, when my colleague Peter Lansbury reported that what was then called NACP, it is alpha-synuclein actually, discovered a different way, was a natively unfolded protein, the world thought that synuclein in your brain and mine occurs as a monomer, and that is then subject to misfolding and aggregation into Lewy bodies. But Tim Bartels in my lab, coming from Munich, and a colleague of his, Tim started the work and he really made the first signal observations, and then Ulf Detmer, a compatriot of his, who I just photographed outside the Keystone meeting the other day, the two gentlemen developed the following story that has been unpopular and controversial, and indeed none other than Tom Sudov, who received the Nobel Prize and the Lasker Prize this year, has taken umbrage to this model and has written about such in response to our paper in Nature. But I've discussed it with Tom, and I think there may be a way out for him. And that is that we have a new model for alpha-synuclein homeostasis in health and disease. The traditional model, according to the Lansbury tenet, is that this protein is an unfolded monomer, and it then can misfold and aggregate into things that become Lewy bodies. And what I'm going to try to propose is that the unfolded monomer may even occur as a folded monomer. We haven't isolated yet, but we have seen a folded tetramer in abundance in healthy neurons. And I'll show you examples of that. And this is a very complicated story whereby this equilibrium, we think, can be perturbed in a healthy neuron, and then the monomer is the one that indeed, as everyone in the field believes, gives rise to the aggregates. So the way this work began was with Tim Bartels' paper in Nature, where he took advantage of the fact that red cells have a lot of alpha-synuclein for reasons we don't really know. Neurons have just as much. And he showed that if he purified under non-denaturing conditions from human red cells taken from himself or someone in the lab, then he could get a beautiful CD spectrum of a folded form of alpha-synuclein, the same as had been known for a decade you could induce by putting a phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine-containing small vesicle together with alpha-synuclein and folding it. You didn't need that if you natively purified alpha-synuclein from a red cell or from a brain cell that was already folded. And this was uncomfortable because it's supposed to be a monomeric and unfolded. He then did attempts at sizing with first principles using a scanning transmission EM or a sedimentation equilibrium, analytical ultracentrifugation. Without showing you the details of this, the peak size of particles of alpha-synuclein on an EM grid were around 55 kilodalton, but there were smaller dimeric particles and larger particles, mostly though around the size of a tetramer. And then a much more precise Beckman ultracentrifugation experiment that's not done very commonly in protein biology anymore showed that the sedimentation coefficient was such that at three different sizes, three different RPMs in the centrifuge, you can predict a protein of 57,875, which is just almost exactly that of four monomers. So a natively purified protein seems to be tetrameric when it comes from a human cell. Now, what's really interesting about this is that Tim showed that this soluble synuclein tetramer had under CT spectroscopy helical fold, but could not be seeded. So you all know that there is a hypothesis that there's a pathogenic spread or seeding phenomenon, like a prion-type disorder, in synucleinopathies, in Parkinson's disease. But we cannot seed the synuclein tetramer when it's physiological, even if we use recombinant, small sonicated seeds of recombinant synuclein, or we denature the red cell synuclein itself. On the other hand, those two preparations, denatured monomeric material, can seed monomers, and even the red cell-derived material shown here can seed and increase thioflavin T fluorescence. So we sat in 2012 with this conundrum. We said that synuclein was natively folded into an alpha-helical-rich thing, and this group at Brandeis, about whose work we knew, said that not only is it helically folded, but it's tetrameric, as these guys said too, and there are a series of four helices with turns, eight helices altogether. Others said not, and so important people in the field, like Hilal Hashul, Eliza Maslia, Omar El-Aganif, and Patrick Abisher said, not so. Alpha-synuclein in the CNS is normally a disordered monomer, not a helically folded tetramer. Then Ulf Detmer rose to the challenge and decided to do in vivo cross-linking. So endogenous cellular synuclein without overexpression, tried to trap it in its native state by applying a lysine-directed cross-linker. So first he made sure that he wasn't falsely cross-linking any old monomer, like tubulin or parkin or RAN in trafficking, and he could not. He never was able to induce a monomer, a monomer into an oligomer, but DJ1, known to be a dimer, and GAPDH and other dimers would be trapped by this application of a cell-permanent, cell-penetrant cross-linker. Here's what happens to synuclein. This is the usual way we study synuclein in lane one here. It's monomeric. If you add the DSG crosslinker, you trap much of it as a tetramer, and then you can do that with three different kinds of lysine-directed crosslinkers. And to see this at a little darker exposure, I'll show it to you here, what we find is that there's this principal 58 or 60 kilodalton species, a tetramer, and two other oligomers of 80 and 100 that we believe are probably conformers of the tetramer. And so you lower the amount of monomer in the cell and you trap some of it in a tetrameric state. What's really interesting is that beta-synuclein, if you know this field, you know that that is a homolog of alpha but is not implicated in Parkinson's disease. It is also trapped as a tetramer, and its monomer level goes down if you lock it in with a cell-penetrant crosslinker in the living state. And what's really striking, that both beta and alpha-synuclein behave the same, so this is physiologic, not necessarily pathologic oligomers, but if you cross-link the same way after you lyse the cell, look what happens. You don't trap hardly any oligomer. There's a little bit of an 80 kilodalton species here, but most of it all comes down as monomer. It's destabilized as soon as you lyse the cell. This is not the way proteins should behave. We think that molecular crowding can stabilize the alpha-syn oligomers that you and I have in our brains. That is, if we use high concentrations of protein, that is small volumes, to lyse our cells, we can recover the appearance of the 60 kilodalton protein shown here and here. So perhaps molecular crowding or another stabilizing factor is necessary. This is certainly not necessary for DJ1, our invariant control protein, which can stay as a dimer. Now, what about in human brain? It's tough because I just told you that if you break open the cell or sonicate it or homogenize it, you lose the ability to see the tetramer. So it actually occurred to me, because I had used the McIlwain tissue chopper, Kathy may remember this used to be in our lab years ago, to chop up brain. If you mince brain tissue, like a human biopsy that I'm showing you in the next slide, or a mouse whole brain, you can chop it into fine pieces and then you spin down the chunks and you throw away the soup so that you get rid of shorn cells and you keep the intact tissue bits. If you take little tissue bits that should have many intact neurons, you cross-link them with the same DSG amine-directed cross-linker, but all of the intact pieces. And then you take that pellet and you can sonicate it, lyse it, and look at what you get. All of the things are done in the intact neuronal state. And what he found is that in this human biopsy from the neurosurgical service at the Brigham, he could see DJ1 in its usual cytosolic state in a dimeric and monomeric form, and he could increasingly cross-linking as such. He could see VDAC as a membrane protein that was cross-linked. Snaptorhythm 2 did not form a cross-linker, but here is synuclein. So from a patient's brain who was approximately 30 years old, had surgery for intractable epilepsy, had a focus removed, and we took the discarded tissue that was not far from that site. It's normal as far as anything about its biochemistry. It doesn't have synuclein abnormalities. And you see that the majority of synuclein runs as the 58 kilodalton tetramer and these two that are probably conformers of the tetramer. So in human brain tissue, and the best, most available relevant source, we can trap synuclein in that state. Notice that abundant tetramers, but fewer no dimers. If we were inducing the cross-linking as for example, Tom Sudov told me we might be doing, we would see a stochastic ladder of monomers and then dimers a little bit less and trimers a little bit less than tetramers. But this protein prefers to populate tetramers, not dimers. And then we can do this in fresh mouse brain. So mouse brain has a bit of monomer, lots of 60, 80, and 100 kilodalton tetrameric species. And that's true for beta-synuclein and alpha-synuclein. And the last part of the story is that Ulf has now been able to express every single one of the familial Parkinson-causing mutations at synuclein in cells. Here you see them named. And then he can use the cross-linking method in intact, healthy cells that express these mutants or wild type. And he can make a ratio of the 60 kilodalton to the monomeric protein with different antibodies, for example. And he can quantify those ratios. And he finds that in every case of a Parkinson-causing mutation, the level of tetramer to monomer is decreased. So the ratio is decreased, pushing towards monomers, decreasing tetramers. And some of them decrease tetramer, some of them increase monomer, some of them do both. Now, the most relevant systems you can do this in are the brains of synuclein knockout mice that express low levels of human wild type or A53T synuclein, or even better, A53T mutant carriers getting skin fibroblasts and deriving neurons from their iPSC cells. Work done by Frank Soldner in the Moody-Janisch's lab at the Whitehead Institute. And these two systems are the last two data slides. This shows, in the case of a mouse brain with low levels of synuclein expression, the A53T, either at its regular level of exposure, or if we artificially overexpose the A53T to match the wild type, in either case, the synuclein tetramer to monomer ratio is reduced by about 30 or 40%, similar to the earlier transfected cells. And then finally, I won't go through all the details, the iPSC cells made into neurons by Frank Soldner and given to Ulf Detmer shows that the cells made into neurons have a lower tetramer to monomer ratio in the case of A53T than in the wild-type isogenic corrected line that the Janisch lab made. So to summarize, alpha-synuclein exists in large part as a natively folded tetramer in cells and brain, an unpopular idea, but one that we think will have more and more evidence for it. In contrast to reports since 1996, the use of non-denaturing and in vivo methods reveals that alpha-synuclein can occur physiologically as a folded tetramer. This form of alpha-synuclein is not natively unfolded, but rather has alpha-helical structure. Native alpha-synuclein tetramers that I believe you and I have principally as our synuclein form from birth on or from before birth on, they resist aggregation. And so it's not the case that synuclein is a highly aggregation-prone protein. Probably no one in this room right now, unless there's some Parkinson patients among us, will have these amyloid-like fibrils or Lewy bodies. Unlike the denatured monomer, and also these synuclein tetramers have a much greater lipid binding capacity that I didn't show you today. In vivo cross-linking traps the 60 kilodalton tetramer and minor 80 and 100 kD species that we have yet to solve, but seem to be conformers. And by the way, we've done mass spec on the 60 kilodalton, and it is bona fide synuclein. Most importantly, freshly biopsied normal human brain from our surgical colleagues has abundant synuclein tetramers as shown by intact cross-linking, and all the Parkinson-causing missense mutations known right now decrease the tetramer to monomer ratio in multiple different experimental systems, best of all iPSC-derived neurons from an A53T patient. So what does this mean? I think these new insights in the physiological nature of synuclein are reminiscent of transthyretin, or what used to be called prealbumin, for which tetramer-stabilizing compounds discovered by Jeff Kelly at Scripps have slowed amyloid formation and been approved by the EMA for nerve degeneration in amyloid polyneuropathy. I'd like to see us find small molecules that stabilize the tetramer or find a limiting factor in cells that naturally stabilizes it. Transthyretin, as its name implies, has a natural stabilizer. It's called thyroxin, which is what it transports. So let me remind you of the names you saw on my slides. The idea that presenilin is gamma secretase was originally the discovery of Mike Wolf with Weiming Shaw, Taylor Kimberly in my lab. The concept of a shedosome, an alpha, gamma, and beta gamma complex that processes proteins very efficiently is Alan Chen's work with help from other members of the laboratory. The whole story on A-beta oligomers and their perturbation of synapses and tau is done by Xiaomin Li, Ming Jin, and Ganesh Shankar with help from Beth Ostachevsky and Ting Yang. Dominic Walsh was our frequent collaborator, Bernardo Sabatini at the medical school, and Kieran Regan at UCD were collaborators on some aspects of this work. And finally, the whole controversy about alpha-synuclein's physiological state was the fault of Tim Bartels and Ulf Detmer. Thank you.